Pro. Okay.
Hi, this is Fred Frith, urging you with terrific enthusiasm to listen to WCVN FM Ann Arbor, and hope to catch you soon.
Good afternoon. You're listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today, so happy to have Perry Janes here in the studio, fresh from out west,
out
in LA. Flew in last night. Perry, welcome back. Welcome to one of your homes.
That's right. Yes. Being here feels mildly surreal, like stepping back into my student days here at University of Michigan. Not bad. It's lovely, but very nostalgic.
How long have you been out and about in the world?
It pains me to say that I graduated in 2012. So it's been about 12 years.
But 2012.
Yeah,
wow, Perry.
I know.
It's been some time.
Yes.
Well, it's good to see you again.
It's good to see you.
Glad
too.
You're back.
It's really lovely.
And you're back for the best of reasons.
Thank you.
It's you're launching your new book of poems.
That's right.
Your debut collection of poems.
Yep.
And this is Find Me When You're Ready.
That's right.
Out with Curbstone Books, Northwestern University Press. So just a stone's throw further.
That's right.
You know,
keeping
away.
Keeping it in the Midwest.
Yes. Yeah. And you've got events coming up tomorrow. It's the Detroit book launch at
27th Letter Books in Detroit. That's right. That's tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. And then this Friday, I'll be at Literati Bookstore at 6:30 p.m. That's going to be with Ann Arbor's own Peter Hodavies and also the brilliant poet Tommy Blount. And then next Wednesday, for anyone listening who may or may not have family or live in Grand Rapids, I'll be at Schuller Books in Grand Rapids.
So that's another location to catch Perry Janes while he's back here in the state of Michigan. And tomorrow, the Detroit book launch, you'll be reading with Nandi Comer.
Thank you. Yes, I'll be
Imani
reading.
Imani Mixon.
Yep, Michigan poet laureate, good personal homie, Nandi Comer.
Yes, and friend of the show.
That's right. And journalist extraordinaire, artist extraordinaire, Imani Mixon. It's going to be a really lovely event.
I haven't read Imani's work yet. Is she going to be reading poems?
She's actually going to be moderating the conversation, but I wouldn't be surprised if she brought something and popped in to read with as well, because, you know, we wanted to keep it very open and convivial. We're all, you know, good friends.
It'll be a good time will be had by all.
I think it's going to be very warm.
And certainly the Literati bookstore reading.
Yes.
What is it like? Is it a rite of passage to be at Literati too?
I'm showing my age here, but when I started as a student, it was actually Shaman Drum was the bookshop.
That's true.
In town.
Yes.
And so I have a lot of memories of going to readings at Shaman Drum. And then around the time that I graduated, and then I actually lived in Ann Arbor for 2 years before moving west. So around that time, Literati opened and started here in town, and I fell in love with the bookstore. So it really does feel a bit like a homecoming. I'm really looking forward to that event.
Yeah, and so good to hear you also talk about Shaman Drum. Still miss
Same.
That place and raise Raymond McDaniel's introductions of each of the writers coming through.
Absolutely.
But at Literati, we'll have Tommy Blount, who,
another good friend.
Awesome poet.
And you know, poet whose work I deeply, deeply admire.
Is Tommy Blount a poet that you've worked with through the years or been friends with through the years?
Yeah, by way of some personal backstory, I actually started in poetry outside the academy. So I started studying poetry with and under the poet Vivy Francis when she was living in Detroit, Michigan. Yes,
yeah, friend Vivy. Of the show.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Amazing. Yeah, Vivy, now one of my closest friends in the universe. And big love to Nandi. I was her intern at Inside Out Literary Arts Project Detroit. Nandi brought me to a community workshop with Vivy and Hamtramck. Vivy and I hit it off. I asked if Vivy would mentor me. And so I became sort of the very last member of a coterie of Detroit poets, all being mentored by Vivy at that time. So that included Tommy Blount. That included Nandi Comer. It also included Ara D. Matthews, Jamal May,
yes.
Erica Foreman, the list goes on. And I count myself incredibly fortunate to have, you know, been brought into that group. I feel we often joke that I'm the baby of the group, you know, sort of felt like the door shut behind me. I was the youngest by an order of magnitude. And what a gift, you know, because it really laid the foundation for my life as a poet.
Yeah, and Francine Harris.
That's
too,
right, Francine.
Right?
Francine, yeah, who Francine. Was my homie here in Ann Arbor for the longest. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is a strong group. It feels like it's like a Detroit. I don't like there needs to be a name for it. Or is there already like a loose name for this group of people at this particular time?
Yes, it's something that we've talked about.
It's a rich and glorious.
Yes. Yeah. Time. Yeah. Occasionally, there are those of us who refer to it as the Detroit School.
Yes, yeah.
So if there are any academics listening, feel free to
take
it and
that.
Run with
yeah.
it. But it really does feel like it was lightning in a bottle. It was this moment in time and space, you know. It does remind me of some of the sort of like historical poetry movements. And it's been really, really rewarding and fascinating and fun to see each of us move out into the landscape. It feels like there's been a bit of a diaspora in ways that are sometimes a little melancholy because not many of us are still here in Detroit, but also really beautiful because we've all really gone and I feel like actualized, right, into the poets and the artists that we were meant to be. Mm-hmm. And just a couple of years ago, actually, in 2022, Vivy hosted the Robert Hayden Symposium at Dartmouth University, in which she brought us all together. She brought almost all the Detroit poets back together for a weekend of reading and, you know, rigorous conversations around poetics and poetry. And it was a really beautiful moment of reunion.
And is that where Vivy is right now at Dartmouth?
Vivy's at Dartmouth. Vivy okay. and her husband, Matthew Olsman,
oh,
another
Matthew
member
well.
Of the Detroit
yes.
School. Yes.
Shout
they
out
are
to
both,
Matthew
that's
as
right.
Well.
Yeah. So they're both over at Dartmouth these days. Yeah.
Yeah. And both of them, like you're speaking to Vivy's, kind of strength and, generosity of craft, like for,
yes.
for mentoring and,
yes.
And cause, and, but Matthew as well with teaching,
Matthew's
young poets.
An incredible teacher as well. I had the great good fortune of going to Warren Wilson College for my MFA, which is where Matthew teaches. And so, you know, Matthew and I had been friends for a while. It would be not unusual for us to exchange text messages on a Michigan game day, for instance, or a Detroit Lions game day. But seeing him really in his element, giving craft talks, hosting workshops, hosting bookshops, he is a really fantastic teacher.
Yeah. And Warren Wilson for your MFA.
Yes.
So did you, Perry, when you graduated from Michigan,
yep.
you were here for a couple of years and then you went to do your MFA, or is that when you moved to California?
That's when I moved to California. So I've had an odd, very blessed, also quite circuitous route as an artist in some respects. Because when I was here at the University of Michigan, I was studying creative writing and poetry and fiction and also filmmaking and screenwriting. For any who remember, this was during the halcyon days of the Michigan film incentives, and so there was a tremendous amount of production happening here in Michigan. I got my first job working as a PA on a Universal Movies film set, decided that I wanted to make my own short film I stuck around an extra year in college to do that, right? So
I had access to so much equipment.
I had access not only to so much equipment, space. But so many resources that I felt were tremendously accessible at the time. And so I decided essentially to go part-time as a student, avail myself of all these resources here, and really just try and make my short film. And so when I graduated, I spent a year taking that around to film festivals, which is a really great way to go broke. And at the very end of that experience, and we did okay. We got into some, I would say, mid-major film festivals around not just the country, but internationally. But we didn't really
Me the name of your film.
Yeah, the short film was called Zug. It was a coming-of-age story set in Detroit. And we didn't really crack the top tier, right? We didn't get into Sundance. We didn't get into Tribeca, you know, the places that are real, like, career makers. And so I remember at the time I was thinking, okay, I'm going to roll up shop. I'm going to stay in Detroit. I'm going to maybe go get my MFA, maybe work on my first book, maybe, you know, work on my first shoestring budget feature film. And the last thing that we sent the short film out to was the Student Academy Awards, which we then went on to win. And so I always say that that was the left turn moment, like, in my life, because I didn't know anyone in LA, unlike your usual film festival where you pay your own way and you go to the filmmaker's lounge and you get your free gin and tonic and you try to meet people. When you win the Student Academy Award, the Academy flies the winners out to Los Angeles and they put you up for a week and they take you around to studios, they introduce you to writers, they introduce you to agents. And so all of a sudden, I mean, I knew nothing, but I knew enough to know that I had like a very, very small window of attention from people in Los Angeles and Hollywood willing to help me. And so truly, I threw all my stuff in a car and westward ho. So that was how I wound up in Los Angeles. And I was there for quite some time, actually, before I went back to get my MFA.
And so it sounds like that one week changed, like you said, it made
my whole
like
life.
A left turn. Like you just completely.
Absolutely.
And so from that, like you were meeting people that you're still working with today.
Mm-hmm.
But you did take a break from that. So you're in this, you're a screenwriter mm-hmm. by day or by day. Trade,
yep, by trade
as well.
That's right.
Right. Which is such, how exciting, right? I feel like that's when I knew you those years ago, I felt like I was like, Perry, I always thought of you more as a film person.
Sure.
But this is why it's also, of course, there's a book of poems in the world. And
Thank you.
I've got a lot of questions here, but
yeah.
when does Find Me When You're Ready, when did some of these poems feel like they've been in the works for a while mm-hmm. in your life? And maybe, can you talk about that? Like how you put, this is your first collection,
yeah.
how you put it together.
Yes, I can talk a little bit about that. And what's interesting is this is my first published collection. This is actually not my first written book. I tend to say actually that.
You do, you have a chapbook, don't you?
I actually don't. I have two manuscripts that weirdly did a great deal for me behind the scenes of my career, but never got published. Right.
Oh.
And so, I tell people, and it's true, that I kind of always thought that I would write this book. This is a very personal book. I am surprised that it is the first book in some ways. And now that I've arrived at this point, I can see that it's probably the right first book. To answer your question, obviously this is a book that I describe as autofictional. So it's being mined from the material of my life. And so some of these poems have been in the works for a tremendous amount of time, but, a lot of them really, I think, began and originated around the time that I did go back to my MFA. Part of the impetus for me going to get my MFA was that I had written a book of poems that had made finalist in any number of contests but had failed to win one. So it felt like always a bridesmaid, never a bride. Full disclosure, that was very frustrating. But also it was a learning experience. With some time, I began to feel that that book wasn't the best that I could do, right? And I began to feel that the poems that I was writing every day were not the best poems that I was capable of writing, right? And so it felt really important to me to go back.
How did, because when you say, are you able to talk about that?
Cause yeah. It's the man, this is going to sound woo-woo, but it is like instinct, you know? At a certain point, I describe it to being an athlete, right? So I think that a lot of the study of art and poetry and fiction, in which the actual practice of making it tends to be, I don't subscribe to the idea that it's like mystical, right? But there's a lot of discovery involved. There's a lot of surprise involved. But I also believe that there's a lot of work that goes into it, right? So I believe that you study craft, right? You learn craft. And then when you show up to the page, you're drawing from those tools, often unconsciously, but you have the tools, right? I could feel that at one point maybe I had more tools, right? Early on when I was really actively studying and I was really immersed in the community of poetry. And I felt like after some time in Hollywood, I needed to get back to that study, right? Like the poems just, my expectations for the poems and the reality of the poems just were not totally aligning. So going back to the MFA was instrumental in that. And I also think that it was instrumental in turning me toward a more personal poetics. I had been writing persona poems for most of my young life. My initial manuscript of poems was written in the voice of and about the life of the inventor Nikola Tesla. And going back to get my MFA, going back to the study of poetry, reading more poetry, really tapping into the things that lit me up about poetry, turned me toward a much more personal terrain. That was four answers to your question.
Just right, Perry. Just right. Today on Living Writers, Perry Janes is here in the studio. His first book of poems, Find Me When You're Ready, out now with Curbstone Press. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Jason behind the glass. We'll be back.
In the tradition of these legendary sports pros, as far as I can see, I've made it to the threshold. Lord knows I waited for this a lifetime, and I'm an icon when I let my light shine. Shine bright as an example of a champion. Taking the advantage, never copping out.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, so glad you did. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and today, poet Perry Janes is here. His book, Find Me When You're Ready. Perry, what? Thanks for picking the songs for today. And Jason, thanks for picking from, I mean, Perry, you sent us a lot, which was great, And so then I think Jason was like, now I will DJ from Perry's, you know.
Only bangers, yes. I was joking earlier that the most paralyzing part of the prep for this interview was selecting songs that I love for the interstitials because... yeah, I'm known to keep music on constant loop in my life.
And what, this song that we just heard?
Yeah, from one of my favorite albums by one of my favorite groups, The Roots. Probably my favorite musical group since I was in high school. And I had the great good fortune of going to see them perform an anniversary concert for their album, Things Fall Apart, at the Hollywood Bowl in Los Angeles, which to this day remains the single best concert I have ever been to in my life.
Wow. Yeah, that does sound super epic.
Pretty great.
Super meaningful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay, before we go any further, I'm going to read, because it's part of our tradition, to read the short bio on the back. We're pulling together pieces of your story and your narrative as we go in the conversation anyway, Perry, but here we go. This is Perry's short bio in the back of Find Me When You're Ready. Perry Janes is a writer and Pushcart Prize recipient from Metro Detroit who lives in Los Angeles, where he works as a screenwriter. His work appears in Poetry, Zizova, Electric Literature, Poem a Day, and elsewhere. So you decided after spending time in Hollywood,
yeah,
on the sparkling and mean streets of Hollywood. Well, I mean, what was that like? Because I was going to say, and you decided you wanted to go back to Warren Wilson, but what was it like those early days there? And how is that kind of feeding who you are as a screenwriter and how you work?
The early days in Hollywood for me looked very much like a cutscene from The Devil Wears Prada. So when I arrived in Los Angeles, again, having won the Student Academy Award, I was one of the only, if not the only undergraduate to win in my year. So it was me and a bunch of NYU, AFI, USC graduate students who were vastly more ready for their moment and also quite a bit older than me. You know, they had scripts, they had
This is
agents.
Not unfamiliar to you if you think about the Detroit school.
Very much. Wow, a really good point you just made, T, and now I need to reflect on that. Yeah,
you can reflect here with us,
often,
Perry.
Often have had the experience in my career of being kind of the youngest through the door in some ways, which has been a blessing and also sometimes an albatross. And so in this case, it was a blessing because it put me on the path of taking screenwriting and filmmaking seriously as a career. It opened a tremendous number of doors for me. But what was unique about it being the only undergraduate is that I wasn't incredibly ready to capitalize on the moment that I had, right? The lone script that I had at that time that I was passionate about was like a very small drama set in Detroit, which was not lighting up anyone's lights in Hollywood. It was not going to make anyone any money is what I'm saying.
I would have chosen it.
Thank you so much. And so I knew that I wasn't really ideally positioned to take advantage of the opportunities in front of me. And so what I was able to do is I said, okay, if there's one thing I want to skip the mailroom. I want to apprentice. I want to work for writer directors who are doing the sort of thing that I want to do. So I was really stubborn about that. And I was really fortunate that it worked out after a couple of months of sort of holding out for something. I got my first job working as an assistant to a writer director. I worked for him for about a year, and then I got a second gig working for another writer-director who I worked for a little over 2 years.
How did you get it, though?
Just by hustling and networking and, you know, throwing up the bat signal to every single person that I had met during the course of the award season tour and saying, hey, I'm here. I have put myself here without a job or a place to live, which in hindsight was a wild thing to do. Please help me, basically. And to the credit of the people that I had met, they showed out and they put me up for interviews. And after a couple of interviews, I got a gig. So the early days were a grind, but they were also incredibly educational. I refer to those 3 years of my life as feeling very much like my MFA in filmmaking.
Because it almost sounded like that when you won the award from the Academy, that it was compressed into a week almost.
Yeah.
Like was an intense sort of MFA in some ways. Like
That week was very intense. And then the next 3 years were also intense because I had never assisted a writer-director before. I didn't entirely know what I was getting myself into.
I mean, what does that even mean on a day-to-day basis, Perry?
It means... I mean, I'm really not joking when I say it means being Anne Hathaway and The Devil Wears Prada, because it is a lot of personal assisting, but it also means going with them to be with them on set every time there's a shoot, getting there before them, leaving after them, managing their personal affairs, managing their schedule, helping them manage their shot list for the day, and also staying by their side and kind of quasi-shadowing them, making sure their meals are prepped, making sure the edit bay is ready for them when they're reviewing dailies. The list goes on. And so during that three-year span, I worked on live-action studio films, animated studio films, single-camera sitcoms, multi-camera sitcoms, just kind of ran the gamut. And so I got to see behind the scenes of everything while I was writing my own scripts and my own poems and fiction as well. So it was a very iterative, very educational time.
And how did you find time to be doing your own work, like keeping the faith with that?
I think... Well, it may just be sheer mule stubbornness, but also it was a keen awareness that there was no point in doing any of this other stuff if I wasn't going to be writing the material to help me get to the next step of my life, right? Like all of the assisting and the networking in the world was never going to do anything for me unless I had work that I believed in that I could show people. And I continued to have new work that I could show people that I had already met, right? It was, I understood that much at least, that it was very important to be creating. Otherwise, all of this other work I was investing was sort of for naught.
Right. And so what did your process look like? Like how, like logistically, how did you do it?
Late nights, honestly, late nights and writing a lot of pages at what we would call Video Village in the business, which is essentially where the monitors are set up for producers and directors on any film set. So to give you just an example, my first job, I interviewed with this writer-director on a Sunday, and on that Thursday, I was on a plane to a foreign film shoot for 6 weeks, never having met this man previously, not knowing what I was getting into there again. And that was an incredibly turbulent 6 weeks, needless to say. But what I also remember from that, one of the writers on that television show is an AMC television show filming abroad, and one of the writers was a novelist. And he was one of the early voices really kind of drumming the lesson into me, you got to keep writing, you got to keep writing, you got to keep writing. And so every time there was downtime at Video Village, every time I kind of knew, okay, the director is off on a complicated setup, he's almost certainly not going to need me for like 25 minutes. I've got my walkie-talkie here. I'd break out the laptop and I would just make myself write, even if the pages were bad.
And you'd be able to just like switch into it, like force yourself, teaching yourself to be able to use any available chunk of time.
It goes back to muscle memory. I was building the muscle, right? I was getting the reps in. And so and even if what I wrote was terrible, and so much of it was, it still was then wet clay to shape later on in aforementioned late nights when I went home and brewed myself a cup of coffee at 1 a.m. and decided to keep writing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like, and for those nights, how many nights can you do that in a row, Perry?
Well, these days, almost none. Aging is a trip, but yes.
Huh, I wondered if we were when we were going to get to that.
Yeah. But early on, it was pretty common that I'd be up pretty late writing, and then that actually flipped when I then became a full time writer and I became more of a morning person. I became more of a morning person when I was really building when my schedule was my own, when my routine was my own. I found that it was actually more conducive to my creative life to wake up and draft earlier in the day before the emails got to me, before the anxiety got to me. It just was the clearest my head was going to be. And so that continues to this day. The late nights have become, I don't want to say early mornings, but it has certainly become a morning practice of writing.
Yeah. And are you able to, like, when you're doing your own thing, what's the screenwriting look like? Because when you say that's your day job, does that put you in the room, or are you writing screenplays and taking them out? And yeah,
the latter. So I've had the blessing and curse, mostly blessing, though some curse, of building my career as a screenwriter entirely on the back of my original material. So it has looked entirely like writing my own scripts or developing my own pitches and ideas and then subsequently selling them to studios or streamers or producers. So I have not had the experience of being in another person's writer's room. I have had the experience of running my own writer's room, which is thrilling. But for the most part, my life as a writer has looked like me in my office with my laptop. So writing a script does not look so different from writing a poem, from writing a story.
And what is it like being like, do you want to be part of more writers' rooms or run them yourselves?
Yes,
or do you?
Absolutely.
Why?
I love the collaborative nature of filmmaking and television making when it is authentic and when it is, I don't want to say pure, but well-intentioned, right? When the process feels good, the collaborative nature of working in Hollywood is thrilling. Obviously, as a poet and a fiction writer, I don't really have the experience of, say, collaborating on a poem with someone else, right? The poem belongs only to me. But when I'm writing for television, right when I had my own room, there was a tremendous amount of building and shaping story together as a team. Even when I'm writing feature film scripts, there's very often what we would call a development team, which basically just means producers and executives attached who give me notes, sort of the way an editor would in the publishing landscape, to which I must then respond and do revisions. And at its best, even that process can feel collaborative. And that's a great joy.
Yeah. What was the TV show you were working on with the writer's room?
I wrote and sold a television show, actually the sort of spiritual successor to my short film Zug. It was a coming of age adventure set in Detroit about three boys. And I wrote it and I sold it to a major streamer shortly before the pandemic. And so I also had the relatively surreal experience of co-running my first writer's room on Zoom in the middle of lockdown. It was very strange. Also, you can probably tell by the tone of my voice, the show did not get made, I think, in large part because of a really fraught, difficult moment in the business, which began, I think, around the time of the pandemic and has kind of frankly patterned through to this moment with the strike and the consolidation and the contractions in Hollywood. It's been a weird time to be working in the business. But having said all that, just the experience of having that room and working with those writers and working with a major streaming network was hugely educational, and I feel vastly more equipped for the next time that, you know, I get that opportunity, if I get it.
Yeah, and a lot of things don't get made. Like, that is that,
yeah.
is that something that you knew going out there, like a frustration for writers where even if you're like so successful and this is how you're making your living, some of the ideas are there. You're nodding and smiling, but yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, I often say that Hollywood thrives on opacity. I did not understand the way that it worked as a business. I did not understand that many, 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 many projects sell and then do not make it to green light. Fewer these days right now than ever, it seems. I joked on a recent interview that it sometimes feels that the distance between writing and selling a thing feels shorter than selling a thing and getting it made these days, which I'm sure feels unfair to to anyone on the other side of that equation, because I know how hard it is to write and sell a thing in the first place. But in the streaming era, and in particular in this moment of major corporate consolidation, so for instance, you know, Amazon owns MGM, Disney bought 20th Century Fox, it's becoming a monopolistic business where there's really kind of like four players in town. And as a result of that, they're able to create more and more intermediary steps between when you sell the thing and you get it made. Multiple checkpoints to hit, right? Multiple people to please, multiple notes to address, some of which come directly from an algorithm. And so it's a harder time, I think, in many respects, post-sale, to get to that green light, just because the process is longer. It's drawn out, and it consolidates a tremendous amount of power in those corporations.
Yeah. Oof. That makes me feel very uneasy.
I paint a rosy picture. I know I do.
No. That's like, oh, America. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I should also say at the same breath that I count myself tremendously fortunate and blessed to be working at all in the business right now.
Yeah, let's just say that. That's like our beginning point
yeah,
for the conversation, right?
Yeah.
I feel like you're making that clear all along.
Thank you.
You really are.
Thank you.
Okay, today on Living Writers, Perry Janes is here. His book of poems, Find Me When You're Ready, out with Curbstone Press. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We'll be back. This will be... Back. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today in the studio, Perry Janes is here. His book on the table with us, Find Me When You're Ready, out now. Tomorrow is the Detroit book launch at 27th Letter Press. No, 27th. It's not a press tee. It's a bookstore. 27th Letter Bookstore in Detroit with Nandi Comer, Imani Mixon.
That's right.
And so that should be awesome. And then on Friday, more local to us, everyone in town here in Ann Arbor, Literati Bookstore on Friday, reading with poet Tommy Blount and in conversation with Peter Ho Davies. So Perry, let's talk about the poems that we have on the table with us today. And yeah, set us up. Tell us a little bit about the structure of the book, how it's in acts, which now I think will be no surprise to listeners, maybe why. And how, because I love like the your structure with the quotes from different writers and or filmmakers or directors. So yeah, tell us a little bit. So, and then I'd love to hear a poem.
Sure, it would be my pleasure. So Find Me When You're Ready is, I describe it as an auto-fictional coming-of-age story about a young boy both growing, coming of age, moving from Detroit to Los Angeles, which will sound familiar, dealing with some childhood trauma and moving into healing. The poems, when I first began to write them, were not so linear in sequence as they appear in the book. I had the sense that I was writing from the perspective of a unifying speaker or narrator, right? Mm-hmm. But early on, the poems, especially as I began to sequence them together into a manuscript, were moving around in time, right? They were sort of elliptical. They were leaping from one moment and experience to another. It was very much, in the truest sense, a, quote, collection of poems, right? I gave that early manuscript to a peer of mine, my scariest reader. I always say, if you have someone in your life and their feedback just scares the daylights out of you, that's who you should send your early work to.
Who is it? Can you say?
Yeah, sure, of course, because she's my dearly beloved friend. She just read with me at the Los Angeles book launch.
Yes.
Cynthia Dewioka, whose book Fire Is Not a Country is one of my favorite collections of poetry. So if you haven't read it, please check it out. She read the early collection, and she called me and she said, you know, Perry, what are you doing? You're a screenwriter. Like, this is a story. Like, you have written a relatively familiar, like, almost archetypal coming of age adventure kind of story for this young character. Put the poems in sequence. Start at the beginning and go to the end and see what happens. And great advice. The poems did tell a story. They really cohered, and it was really interesting to see it happen because the poems themselves tend to be fairly lyric, meaning in this case that they're relatively abstracted from a specific time and place, and they live in the speaker's reflective thought, right? But when put together, my hope for the book is that the gestalt of the book is greater than the sum of its parts, and it really does have that kind of familiar, honestly, character arc that you see in films that you might love. And that's where the act structure comes from. Five act structure is one of a couple of screenwriting structures that you learn very early on. And when I applied it to this book, it just really neatly fell into place.
And Perry, when you say autofiction,
yes.
So why the fiction part? Like,
yeah.
Is it why the distancing with that? If what when because you mentioned when you talked about Warren Wilson,
yes.
This finding this drive towards the personal, not
yeah.
not persona, but to the personal.
Yep. I think it comes from some of my influences, right? So Alexander Chi, How to Write an Autobiographical Novel, I think is one of my major influences, as is his book Edinburgh. Honestly, our own Peter Ho Davies, whose most recent book is an autofictional novel, I think that I'm not at all shy about this book containing a tremendous amount of my autobiographical sort of material in life. But what I didn't want was the veneer of autobiographical disclosure to distract from the poems themselves, from the experience of the poems themselves. And I also knew that the speaker that I was crafting on the page is in some respects different from me, right? Is in some respects an avatar for me, and even down to some of those autobiographical details. So, for instance, actually, the poem in the book from which the title is drawn is very much about absent fathers. It's about the speaker dealing with an absent father. I did not have an absent father. I had a tremendously present, loving, gentle father in my life. But many, if not most, of my friends when I was growing up did have absent fathers, and I found that as masculinity was an emerging theme in the book, that became a salient experience for this speaker and for this story, right? And so I say autofictional just to say, listen, I'm not shy about talking about the very sort of personal aspects of this particular book, but I also wouldn't want someone to read it and think, ah, and here in every poem is the sort of facts of this writer's life.
And sometimes I think with poems anyway, you might think you're doing one thing or the other anyway.
Yeah.
You might think that you're not writing a poem. You have distance. You're not there. But often people outside or maybe even a self can recognize themselves in it. And then sometimes you can think that, oh, you're. This is not me. And some people like swear by it. Oh, this is not at all me.
Yes.
And then you're like, well,
too true.
It's straight. Like when you made the joke and it sounds familiar that the character goes from Detroit to LA,
yep.
You know?
Yep.
So it's interesting as artists. Sometimes I think we're also struggling to name what is happening mm-hmm. and what mm-hmm. the possibilities can be.
Mm-hmm.
But I it's really, it, thanks for talking about what was like driving your vision for this and what you felt was needed, because maybe this voice, this narrator is representing like more than the self, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. This narrator and the story in these poems does incorporate the lived experience of some of my closest friends, right? And things witnessed or experienced by proxy, et cetera, sort of found their way into this book. I don't think that I would feel the need to say something like, this is an autofictional piece of work, if it were truly just a collection of poems, right? If every poem was changing speakers or instance or et cetera, but because it is a single speaker slash narrator, and because it is a character arc that is being experienced, it has felt, and maybe it's my own neuroses, but it has felt important to kind of lead with that qualifier, or at least that description for the book, so that people understand what they're getting.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Perry, let's hear a poem.
It would be my pleasure. Ars Poetica as love poem with autocorrect, or Mission U. We're far enough into the future. What I call nightlight might also mean the dozen or so screens that brighten my living room furniture. Far enough, what I mean by death, might also be the slow replacement of my hands, the way they tremor when I laugh, by photos that live somewhere on a server in Arizona, each hard drive filled with theaters I rotate in the dark, smiling. I admit, there are days I require language to make my body and the world feel real. Days I walk headlong into my words and find nothing I recognize there. Not the goose-like form of shoes stormed against the door. Not the shape of bed quilts left by morning's hurried departure. Shoot, we're far enough into the future. There should be a word by now to say, I have unsubscribed from this email chain on 10 separate occasions, and now I am prepared to break my phone. A second word for the 1,001 times I have tried to unsubscribe from that feeling I sometimes get between my toes after a long run. Numbness, I'm silently terrified, means nerve damage. Or maybe we're far enough now from our bodies, our landscapes. We've lost lexicon to faithfully describe the ocotillo, how it sprouts from the desert like hair from the dead, how the desert stretches out and out until, finally, the distance between myself and the world no longer seems so strange. The idea of leaving it now, no stranger than the word abacus, meaning a beaded string scholars once used to tally up their days. Far, whatever, but maybe not so far. Language can't still keep me. The surprise of my phone's corrective mind, how missing you becomes mission you, and there it is. Accuracy. The body I've waited for. Body, yours, I need. One small toe reaching farther than its neighbors. Fat tumor blooming below the shoulder that I kiss to keep well-loved and benign. You, magpie comedian, laughing in your mother's voice. You, houseplant empath, gently misting their leaves. You, objective and journey, obstacle, reward. Our future blinks by, surprising and mundane, and look how far we've come. You and I, needing only the word our feet make as they walk side by side.
Thanks, Perry.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Why did you choose to read that one?
It's a good question. That tends to be the poem I lead with at readings, in part because it's an Ars Poetica. And for those who don't know, an Ars Poetica is a very loose poetic form that essentially amounts to the poet's kind of manifesto on what moves them, why they write how they write. And so it feels like a good first piece philosophically. In that way, it also feels inviting tonally, right? It's one of the poems in the book that I think has a wider dynamic tonal range, which is something that has increasingly become of value to me, both as a poet and as a reader. And also, it comes from the end of the book, right? And so I think that it's a good representation of where this character arrives, right? And as a story about arc and about healing and about finding love and et cetera, it's always appealing to me to start there. And then I can double back and kind of take you through the journey.
Because that is interesting, because if you weren't organizing it more narratively or chronologically, this could have done a different kind of work, couldn't it?
Absolutely.
But I love hearing the work that it's doing and how it's towards the end.
Yes.
And why, let's see, and what is the last poem, Perry? Let's take a look.
It's also, ironically, it's the poem that I tend to end all of my readings with. It's called The Cookout. Yeah.
And how did you choose The Cookout to be the final? Like,
what's funny is that The Cookout, and I had some real reservations about putting it at the end, because The Cookout, in some respects, is a pandemic poem. So it's the only poem in the book to reference the pandemic. It references it very early. It's about the experience of being in lockdown and feeling separated from people you love. But when I was sequencing this collection, I had to admit to myself that, first of all, it's just one of my favorite poems in the book. We all have our darlings as writers, and that's one of mine. But also, I began to think of it more and more as just a mid-30s poem, right? The thing that I found in my mid-30s is that, you know, I've spent the last 10 to 15 years building these communities in time and place full of people that I love, full of, you know, chosen family, as it were. And as we head toward our mid-30s and people want to buy homes, have kids, parents and family get older, there's a bit of a migration back sort of home, or at least away from the organizing space that we all shared together. And this is a poem that's very much, I think, about calling out to your friends, to the people that you love, and finding ways to feel held by them and to hold them even when they're not there.
So in a way, that's a lovely send-off then for Find Me When You're Ready.
It was important to me to end there, in part also just because it's a real nod, I think, both on behalf of the speaker and also just me as a poet, to the fact that none of us exists independent of one another, and acknowledging the absolute importance of that love and support from friends and family and people in your life. I mean, that poem is expressly about that, and that just felt like the right place to end.
Let's take a short break. Today on Living Writers, Perry Janes is here. His book of poems, Find Me When You're Ready. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and we'll be back.
How have things been, well, love, now that you mention it? Folks still talk, but they speak in these two-word sentences. I'm saying too much, but you know how it gets out here. No winter cold could keep out all the cold of your atmosphere. We once sang retrograde, we'd shake the frame of your car. Now I know your name, but not who you are. It's all okay, there ain't a drop of bad blood. It's all my love, you got all my love. I'm still out here with the pills and the dogs. If you need me, dear, I'm the same as I was. It's all okay, there ain't a drop of bad blood. It's all my love. How it was, how it has to be. You burrowed in under my skin. What I'd give to have you out for me.
Hello and welcome back. You've got Living Writers. Today on the program, Perry Janes is here. His book, Find Me When You're Ready. Perry, thanks again for choosing songs for today's program.
Such a joy.
And it's very, yeah, that's been a lovely musical time, and the lyrical, like, lines from the poems that we're getting to hear. Would you read another poem?
Certainly. I'm going to read a poem now, doubling back to early in the book. So a poem that's much more about the childhood of this particular character, narrator, speaker.
So this is Act One, and it comes after, yep. In the structure, there's two poems, right?
There's two poems that open the book, yes.
And then, and why were there two poems? Why did you do that and then Act One?
I think of them, wow, this is really me showing my screenwriting cards, but I think of them a little bit like a cold open, right? So like, if you remember, say, the pilot of Breaking Bad, which starts with a sort of attention-getting moment in the story, right, that then kind of draws you into the narrative before doubling back in time. I wanted to give people a sense of what they were going to find in the book writ large, and so the first two poems that open the book, one is labeled Backstory, the other is Love Poem is Trojan Horse. One is very much about childhood in Detroit, and then one is very much about life and love in Los Angeles. And so there's a little bit of a sort of gesture to the scope and sweep of what you're about to get in the experience of the book before we kind of begin the journey in real time. Okay. This music. As a child, I had a tendency toward the chronic. Ear infections, outbursts, nightmares. Through 5 long years, I carouseled in and out of exam rooms, schoolyards. Through 2 more, I curled at the foot of my wireframe bed, closest to the open door and its offering of light. When my mother or father happened past to find me there, late or not so late, they would stop to sing me lullabies, wordless ditties I now know they must have forgotten the lyrics for. Eventually, I fall asleep, and when I woke hours later, to find blood on my pillow, urine, wet sheets, the ritual recommenced. I never wondered what these intrusions meant for their own sleepless nights, if they whistled the same melody through 12-hour days and graveyard shifts into grocery bags knotted with discount produce or phones left off the cradle to reject angry collectors, if they ever tired of it, each evening ending with their hands cupped at my ears, where they hummed their off-key tune to soothe me back to sleep. Years later, in high school, the gaunt-faced teacher already eyeing college admissions assigned us to write about a period of suffering or struggle in our lives. When I stood at the front of the class to recite what I'd written, even my teacher betrayed his surprise and something like satisfaction by my little efforts at lyric. Finally, I thought, some use for it all, and rushed home to perform for my parents, pleased at this music I believed I had made.
Thanks, Perry. I love that. This music I believed I had made.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a moment of, like, that doubleness of believing, like, coming into your own. Mm. But by the very belief is what actually is the key to it.
Yeah, and I think also by coming into your own, understanding how much you've been given, right? Understanding how much of that music is inherited from the parents singing to the boy at night when they can't pay the bills, right? And a sort of clarity that comes later of looking back and realizing that your voice is inextricably tied to and bound up in the people, the places, and the things that made you.
So how, this seems like it's very much connected to this idea of personal poetics that you mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say, like, what are you, now that you're, are you mid-30s?
Yes, I am. That's right.
I'm not trying to be ageist or anything.
No, please.
So what would you say personal poetics means to you at this moment? Acknowledging that it will probably always change.
Yeah, it's actually an excellent question because I think I'm at a pivot point in my personal poetics. I think that writing this book was very much the work of confronting stories I had told myself about myself and rewriting them, and that was challenging on a personal level, on a craft level. It was tremendously vulnerable and inward-looking and reflective, right? and also just as a result of some of the subject matter of the poems, often quite weighty, right? I mentioned earlier how much I'm drawn to poems that have a wide dynamic tonal range. One of the things that I find in the poems that I'm writing now, organically, nearly finished with a second manuscript, so keep your fingers crossed that that gets placed, is a series of poems that very much look outward from the self and also are much more interested in playing with tone, so being conversational or even humorous, right? Or ironic or misanthropic, and using a sort of initial tonal bandwidth to set a version of expectations for the reader that then I get to subvert, right? And so the new poems are quite in some respects different from the poems that you'll find in here, although fittingly the poems toward the back of this book in Act 5 feel much more like the poems that I'm writing now. And so as a representation of the speaker's growth and maturation and my own, I think that in some respects this book, when read front to end, will lead fluidly into what follows.
And I mean, that is sort of, I mean, a poet's hope. We hope that the any poem is goes out on its own into the world and it's read. But when you put it together in this book form.
Yeah. It's exciting. It's nerve-wracking. I do believe that this book taken as a whole is an experience, right? Separate from reading any individual poem. And so I'm proud of that, and it's important to me, and I hope very much that it finds people, not to pun on the cover, but I mean it.
I love that. Today, I've enjoyed you so much talking, love talking with you, Perry. Yeah. Today on Living Writers, Perry Janes, his book, Find Me When You're Ready. Perry will be in Detroit tomorrow for the Detroit book launch at 27th Letter Bookstore with Nandi Comer and Imani Mixon. Perry will be here in town on Friday at our very own Literati bookstore with poet Tommy Blount and the incomparable Peter Ho Davies in conversation with Peter Ho Davies. Yeah. And will Tommy Blount be talking too in the conversation?
Tommy is actually just reading.
He's reading. Well, that'll be beautiful anyway, the poems of Tommy Blount. Okay. And thanks so much, Perry, again for being here today.
Thank you.
And safe journeys and wonderful time with this book tour ahead. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks, Jason, for being behind the glass, making us sound good. Good night, everyone. Goodbye, Mom. Thanks for listening. Until next time.
To stay, I'll be around today to be available for you to see. I'm about to go, and then you'll know for me to stay. I got to be me. You'll never be in doubt. That's what it's all about. You can't take me for granted and smile. Come on, please. Reaching me by phone, because I promise I'll be gone for a while. When you see me again, I hope that you have been the kind of person that you really are now. We got to get in straight. How could I ever be late when you're my woman taking up my time? Oh! Fun, how, when you know that you're never number two. Number one, gonna be number one. I'll be good, I wish I could. I get this message over to you now. you shake me again. I hope that you have been the kind of person you really are now. I'll be so good. I wish I could get the message over to you now.
Hello, you are listening to WCBM, CBN FM Ann Arbor. It is 6 o'clock. That was Living Writers, and now it is time for the Daily Sports Report. 6 o'clock here in Ann Arbor. I'm Alex Miller, joined by a special guest today, my brother Jacob Miller, in the studio. Fun show coming up here today. The Detroit Tigers just took down the Houston Astros in the wild card series and are moving on to the American League Divisional Series. Coming up, game one on Saturday. Jacob, how you doing this fine evening?
Doing well, doing well. I mean, the Tigers just won an incredible series against Houston, and they're moving on to the divisional series. So this is great timing for this, Alex.
No doubt about it. We got lucky on the schedule. I saw an open day here on the Daily Sports Report sign up, and I was like, let's double up. I hosted on Monday Michigan football. Let's do the Tigers in the middle, or what I thought might be the middle of this series. Instead, Tigers 2-0 sweep over the Astros in the wild card round today. 5-2 win. The big swing, Jacob, came off of the bat of Andy Ibañez.
Yeah, Andy Ibañez. I mean, he's been their guy all season when you see a lefty pitcher, and Josh Hader was on the mound in the ninth. In the eighth, and they put him in, right? They don't hesitate to pinch hit in situations where they see a matchup, and Hinch loves having Ibañez against those lefties, and it came in really clutch with the bases loaded to knock in three.
I mean, it's not a surprise that the Tiger, I mean, as soon as Hader was in the game, we kind of knew, okay, this is a spot that Andy Ibañez will get on the season, hit 292 against left-handed pitching. He's been Hinch's guy in those spots all year long, and that's really been what's gotten this Tigers team to this moment. The hot stretch down the home stretch of this season was fueled by, I mean, the national broadcast talked about it a lot tonight, but just go in more depth of this pitching chaos. Every single guy can get pinched for any day of the week. I mean, we saw it. Kerry Carpenter, even in the ninth inning, was